Hanukkah is not the most important Jewish holiday, but it is certainly one of the most delicious. We'll start the hour today with a celebration of the food of Hanukkah. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. After we feast, we'll find out about a remarkable but little-known figure in Jewish history, Queen Salome Alexandra. She once ruled Judea, and her 9-year rule was a time of unparalleled peace and prosperity. She's the only woman whose name is written on the Dead Sea Scrolls. Today, I'll talk with Kenneth Atkinson, author of Queen Salome, Jerusalem's warrior monarch of the 1st century BCE. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. As Jewish people in Iowa and around the world are celebrating Hanukkah, we're going to talk about an important but nearly forgotten figure in Jewish history, Queen Salome Alexandra. But we're going to start this hour with the foods of Hanukkah. My guest is Rabbi Yossi Jacobson. He is the Chabad emissary in Des Moines. He also runs Maccabee's Kosher Deli, the only kosher deli in the state. Hello, Rabbi Jacobson.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's an honor.
And, of course, for people who are not Jewish and lay people, we know that Hanukkah is the festival of lights. For those of us who don't celebrate Hanukkah, remind us just briefly what it's about.
Hanukkah, well, do we start from when God revealed himself to Abraham or from when the Jews left Egypt? But we're not going to go all the way back there. Hanukkah, in a nutshell, is celebrating miracles like we celebrate in our own lives, celebrating the miracles that happened in Israel over 2,100 years ago during the Assyrian-Greek takeover of the land of Israel, promoting and pursuing their culture over the Jewish way of life. The Maccabee family, which was the priestly family led by the general Judah the Maccabee, the revolt revolted against the Assyrian Greeks and overcame the greatest army in that time. And when they came from the mountains of Judah, Samaria, after the Greek army ran away from all corners of Israel, they rededicated Israel to the Jewish way of life and rededicated the temple. They couldn't find oil to light the menorah, which would be a symbol of victory, a symbol of rededication, and being allowed to focus our hearts and minds to God Almighty. They were looking for a jug of oil that was not contaminated ritually, looking for a seal of a jug that was somewhere. And they found it in the bottom hidden in the corner, a jug of oil that would be enough to last one day. It lasted 8 days. And so this oil lasted 8 days. Every morning they woke up, the fire was gone, but the oil never was consumed. And because of this miracle, this is where the foods that have to do with oil were born. People celebrated Hanukkah every year eating donuts or potato latkes, potato pancakes. And that's what we have been doing every night when we light our 20-foot menorah in front of the Maccabee Deli, which, you know, we named it after the Hanukkah story. We give out donuts or latkes. So anyone who wants to get tonight at 5 o'clock, there will be latkes available for those who come to the menorah lighting.
And that's what makes Hanukkah one of the most delicious Jewish holidays. It's not, however, one of the most important Jewish holidays, right?
Every holiday is important and is significant for its time. But it's not a holiday like Passover that, you know, we abstain from doing work and, you know, we celebrate like we do other, or like Yom Kippur or like Rosh Hashanah. This is a rabbinical holiday. It's a festival. It's a celebration of life at that time. And we take from it, every one of us, Jew or non-Jew, to rededicate every morning we wake up realizing the Almighty gives us a second chance to make a first impression. He doesn't judge us and not giving us the gift of life. On the contrary, everyone who wakes up in the morning, God says, I'm giving you another day to be my partner. And what happened yesterday was yesterday. This is a second chance to make a first impression, and this message hits home at this time of year more than any time, because it's about rededicating, you know, where the morale and esteem of Jewish life was completely fading away. And here, not only did it come back equally, it came back even stronger. And we commit to the light of the Jewish way of life, and we commit to the zesty and all the shades and colors of the teachings of our Torah throughout the year to guide us. And at this time of year, it's we draw strength through this commitment and take it throughout the year. So part of it is eating and enjoying, and like I said, in Israel, it's what's known as safgoniyot, the donuts, the jelly donuts, the chocolate donuts. And in America, we push more the potato latkes. But there's quite a few Israelis here who live in Iowa that still demand from us to get those donuts out and bake them, and so they could feel the spirit of the holiday even in Des Moines, Iowa.
Let's talk about the latkes for a little while. When there are potato pancakes in many people's ancestry, no matter what they believe. So there are also many, many different kinds of potato pancakes. What makes a latke special?
What makes a latke special? Well, first of all, everyone will tell you it's their grandmother's latke that is the best, or their mother's. Nothing would ever match their mother's latke. I think what makes it special is the actual dedication of the family coming together and preparing it. And making that effort, you know, it's not something that, you wiggle with your nose and it appears. You have to cut the potatoes, and everyone is involved in making it and bringing it to its full taste and its full readiness, crispy readiness. I think, in Jewish life, we know you have to make an honest effort to really reap the fruit of that effort, and I think it's the making it and seeing the grandmas or the mothers, frying away and getting everyone involved and everyone enjoying it. I think it's from the beginning to end that is the experience. It's not just eating latkes; it's making them, and that's why you always hear between different families, "You got to taste this grandma's latkes. You got to taste this one." And people actually come together, and they have latke contests, and I think it's more the latke carries. I mean, you could eat latkes the whole year, but Hanukkah it has an extra dose of reliving the time and allowing that time to permeate not just our spirit but our physical bodies, and live those festivities then and enjoy it, and I think that mindset creates a greater appreciation to the potato latke, to the donut.
And with the latkes, there are different ways to eat them. Do you like to eat them with sour cream? Do you like to eat them with applesauce? What is your preference?
Well, like I mentioned to many people, sour cream, there are different foods other than potato latkes and donuts we do eat. Dairy is encouraged because the aunt of Judah the Maccabee was also, there were many women who were also involved in trying to free the land of Israel from the Assyrian Greeks. Yehudit, Judith, was involved in actually weakening the general of the Greek army in pursuing him and feeding him dairy and wine till he fell asleep. And when his force of Greek army heard that his life was taken, that weakened them, and they retreated back.
So once he fell asleep, then she killed him.
Basically, yeah.
Okay, and so really, it was the cheese.
I tell you, you got to watch out when the woman invites you to have cheese and wine. Watch out. And so, the cheese got him thirsty, and the wine went out. And you have to understand. At that time, it was brutal. The Greek army would not allow anyone getting married, would have to first live with the general of the army first. This was a way of emotional, spiritual, to dominate and to abuse and to constantly remind the Jewish people that they are to be completely disarmed to their culture, to the Greek culture. So it was a brutal time as well during that time. So everyone contributed. Those who were not going to go down without a fight. So that is one of the reasons why sour cream or cheese products are eaten. Latkes and sour cream, I don't know who decided that would be a good combination, or the applesauce. That's something that came along. I actually looked up a source, because you're talking about God delivered us miraculously, the many, the few, the many in the hands of a few. It was a time when bitterness was transformed to sweetness. So, like I say, everything in Jewish life, every food we eat, if it's the Passover, matzah balls or matzah on Passover, or apple and honey on Rosh Hashanah, all these foods are literally a way of connecting spiritually, emotionally, and physically to the message of that time. And we bring it down from this world, from the mundane world, and not isolate ourselves from the world like other religions, but we bring out our pride from the earth, you know, making heaven on earth through the earth and living and help live. And I think the latkes and applesauce, or latkes or sour cream, this is all part of getting the marrow of this time.
And before we run out of time, we should talk for just a moment about the donuts. And you said sufganiyot, is that how you say it?
Sufganiyot is the known name of the Hanukkah donuts.
Serious donuts. These are filled donuts. They look really heavy.
Oh, boy, let me tell you. I mean, the traditional one is to have the jelly donuts, but in Israel, I mean, chocolate, white chocolate. I mean, look, no one in the Jewish faith starts their diet right before Hanukkah. That's what I tell you. It always starts after. That's what it is.
I have a good friend who's celebrating Hanukkah this week, and he shared a picture of the donuts that they made in their household, and he said, "Holiday sanctioned donuts, Jews for the win."
Did you also see the Diet Coke right by the donut? Did you see that too?
No. I think that'll wait for next week, okay. Probably for him. Oh, Rabbi Jacobson, thank you so much for your
time.
Thanks
for having me.
Take care. Happy Hanukkah.
You too.
Rabbi Yossi Jacobson, he is the Chabad emissary in Des Moines. He also runs Maccabee's Kosher Deli, the only kosher deli in the state. And as he said, donuts are available tonight at 5 o'clock as they light their giant menorah. In a moment, we're going to talk about a very important but nearly forgotten figure in Jewish history. Her name is Queen Salome Alexandra, and she's been written about and rediscovered in many ways by Kenneth Atkinson of the University of Northern Iowa. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and now we're going to talk about a remarkable but little-known figure in history. Her name is Queen Salome Alexandra, and Kenneth Atkinson, an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa, has written about her life and rule in the new book Queen Salome, Jerusalem's Warrior Monarch of the First Century BCE. Kenneth, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And I think that for a lot of us, when we hear the name Salome, we immediately think of the dancing girl who danced for King Herod. This is not her.
No, this is the famous Salome who danced for Herod, responsible for cutting off the head of John the Baptist, was named after Queen Salome Alexandra. Okay. She was so renowned in antiquity that her name became the second most popular name for women after Mary.
So many, many people were named after Queen Salome.
Yes, yes.
I think it's important in understanding who she was to understand her family and her lineage. So we were just talking about the Maccabees and how they are so important in this Hanukkah celebration that's going on. But tell me a little bit about the Maccabee family and her lineage.
Yeah, she is a member of the family known as the Maccabees. The actual name of the family is the Hasmoneans. but they're most commonly known as Maccabees after Judas Maccabee, who is the most famous member. And Maccabee is actually a nickname given to him, meaning the hammer. And she's one of the descendants. They fought the Syrian Greeks, created an independent Jewish state, the last independent Jewish state until 1948. And this time of year, we're celebrating Hanukkah, which commemorates Judas's recapture of Jerusalem. And her family went on and created an independent state, a monarchy. And she's the only female ruler of ancient Jerusalem ever in history. And she ruled from 76 to 63 BCE. And it's quite a remarkable period of history which she ruled.
Well, and the rulers who came before her didn't distinguish themselves in many ways. There are some terrible, sordid tales about the rulers that came before her.
Yeah, it's a pretty dysfunctional family. And what was remarkable, one of the things that attracted me to her is that later on in the Talmud, written many centuries later, they said that the golden age of Jewish history was her reign, which is quite a remarkable thing to say.
Absolutely. Well, it's one thing to say there are sordid tales of the monarchs that came before her, but give me a little bit of an idea of how dysfunctional this monarchy was.
Well, her husband, who ruled for nearly a quarter century, was a pretty mean character, constantly fighting civil wars. Once he crucified 800 of his opponents in one day. So pretty nasty fellow, sort of with concubines. And her relatives pretty much knocked one another off, political assassination, warfare, murder. It was pretty commonplace in her day. Life was pretty cheap.
Her marriage was unusual by modern terms. This was a May-December marriage, but not in the way that we normally think. Her husband was very young, what, 14 or 15 years old?
Yes. It's very unusual.
And how old was she?
And she's much older in her early 20s, roughly about early 20s. I'd estimate, about 29 or so by the time she married.
So this was probably an alliance made by their families.
Yes, and it says quite a bit about her that she was not married, because most women married when they're very young. And she's a pretty headstrong ruler, and I believe that she was picked because her husband was not supposed to be king. He was the youngest of the family. He became king because he's the only one who survived. And
because the others killed each other, basically.
Yeah, and she was more of a strong, domineering person who would kind of keep this wayward son in line. And the Jewish historian Josephus, who wrote in the first century AD, whose account tells us most of what we know about her, says that her husband was sent to the Galilee to live for a while, which is pretty unusual. It sounds like they were worried the brothers were going to knock him off. He was a pretty unpopular character. And so she was the formative person for much of his life.
But there, between the two of them, it sounds like there was strife. I mean, you mentioned that he wasn't a very savory character, but she had very firm religious beliefs, and her religious beliefs were not the same as her husband's.
No, which is very unusual. And most listeners familiar from the New Testament have heard of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, which were the two dominant Jewish groups. Her family were Sadducees, which they were high priests, they were political rulers, they created a monarchy, they operated the temple, they did not believe in resurrection, angels, had a distinctive interpretation of Jewish law. She was a Pharisee, which they believe in resurrection, believed in something called the oral law, traditions that Moses passed down orally, they were carried down by the rabbis. And mainstream Judaism today is based on the Pharisees. Jesus was very close to the Pharisees, which is why he's debating them. So they had completely different interpretations of Judaism. And when she became ruler, she could serve as a monarch, but not as high priest. So she appointed one of her two sons as high priest, the elder Hyrcanus, who was a Pharisee, and her other son, Aristobulus, was a Sadducee. So pretty dysfunctional family.
Well, and during the time that her husband ruled, wasn't he actually oppressing the people who shared her beliefs?
Yes. And there are many stories in the Talmud about his oppression of the Pharisees. And she was a patron of a very famous rabbi called Shimon Bar Shetach, who's responsible for many innovative reforms in Judaism, including the Ketuvah, the marriage contract, which is still in place today. And she protected him from her husband's wrath, the Pharisees hid them, and helped push to get Pharisees in the legal system, the Sanhedrin, the main court. So many religious laws today that are the basis of modern Judaism and which influenced Christianity, she really pushed during her husband's reign.
And it's interesting to me, again, with these tales that you tell of the monarchs that came before, it's interesting to me that she was protected during her husband's reign. If she disagreed with him, you know, some of the other kings that you write of before, one had thrown his mother was supposed to rule. His father had said that his mother should rule after his death. So he throws her in jail where she dies of starvation.
Yes.
And then his brother challenges him for the throne and he has him killed. And then he dies of a broken heart or something like that, or probably
yes,
probably a disease. But if this man, if her husband felt that his wife was challenging him and his beliefs and his rule, how do you think she got away with that during that time?
Well, all the traditions uniformly say that she was famous for her piety, that most of the high priests at this time, they're basically warriors. They're not very religious. They're horrible people. They're committing murder, incest, you know, adultery. And she was very, very devout, opposed her husband's unpopular policies. She was against the warfare. And she seemed to be a very competent ruler. And her husband most of the time was away campaigning, invading neighboring countries. And she was, in a sense, de facto ruler. So he needed her.
And the people did not like him, but they did seem to like her.
Yes. When he died, she had two grown sons.
Which one would expect one of them would have become king.
Yes, and they wanted her, and which meant that she selected the high priest, which was unprecedented. And she changed the course of religion from the Sadducees to the Pharisees, laid the framework for what becomes mainstream Judaism, and the Judaism that Jesus would have practiced, would have known, was the Judaism that she largely created.
So in many ways, she was almost an elected monarch, it sounds like.
Yes, yes.
There wasn't a democracy, but the people chose her.
Yes, and which says she must have been very popular because there's no revolts during her reign. The people willingly accepted her.
Well, and she inherited a mess.
Yes.
I mean, tell me, describe the mess that she inherited when her husband's reign ended.
Yeah, and what really got me interested in the topic when I was in graduate school starting in 91, the Dead Sea Scrolls were just released to the public. And one of my professors, a man named John Collins, was assigned many of the scrolls. So we had access to the photographs for the first time. And the Dead Sea Scrolls are a collection of manuscripts discovered in 1948 along the Dead Sea in Israel. And I was interested in historical incidents, names in the text. And I looked and I found two references to her. And there are only about 10 people mentioned by name in these texts. And I thought, who's Salome Alexandra? And my teachers didn't know much, looked in the reference books. Her husband, Alexander Janaeus, was king, constant civil war, 27 years. Nation's about to fall apart. She takes power. Nothing happened during her reign. See her sons take over. They fight the Romans, conquer the country. And every book said nothing happened. I thought, for a 9-year reign, this just doesn't make sense. And that's what really led me in this quest to find information in the past. And I've argued in the book, I've uncovered a lot of evidence that her reign was really the golden age, that she immediately she finished her husband's wars, immediately stopped them, made treaties, built up the military for defensive purposes, and kept the country at peace. The economy was booming. And so she was a great success.
We've mentioned a couple of times that her name was mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls. This was not an honor.
No, no.
So she was not mentioned in a very flattering way at all. Give me the context that she was written about in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, the Dead Sea Scrolls were written by a group we believe were called the Essenes. We're kind of a very radical, conservative group. They did not like the Hasmoneans, thought the temple was impure. And one branch moved to the desert, created the world's first monastery at a site called Qumran. And they did not like the Hasmoneans, and they're very sexist. So they look at her reign, and they took the prophetic books, Nahum, Habakkuk, and whenever they found references to prostitutes, sexuality, they said, this is a prophecy of her. They portray her as this horrible seductress, this prostitute, this evil woman. So she struck out in two counts. She's a woman and she's a Hasmonean. and they just couldn't stomach a woman being a successful ruler. But most of the Dead Sea Scrolls date to her reign, and a number of Dead Sea Scrolls talk about women leaders during her reign. So during her time in power, women did achieve a little more prominence in Judaism. They weren't equal, but even the Essenes recognized women as teachers. There are punishments for women teachers who were disrespected. And one scroll even mentions a woman scribe. So this was sort of a renaissance for women during her reign.
Well, and she also, pardon me, during her reign, she also made sure that girls went to school.
Yes, yes, which is unique. And that shouldn't be too surprising because in Judaism, it's largely a religion based in the home. And women have to instruct the children, keep the purity laws, prepare the food. So they need to know a great deal about the law. And that's why Shimon bar Shetach, the rabbis, very much supported this policy, that girls should have a basic literacy.
So when you discovered her name in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that made you think, well, here's someone who must have been very prominent and important because these people would not have been looking for prophecies about her. They would not have been saying such horrible things about her if she wasn't important. But when you went back to look, you just didn't find much.
No, there was no book ever written about her life. And people said it couldn't be done because the only accounts we have, the Jewish historian Josephus, who clearly did not like her, only records her last 9 years of her life. It doesn't tell us much about her. So it took many years looking through texts, finding little clues, little references here. And I found many texts scholars had overlooked just because they'd never gone in search of, looking for references to her. I found out that there are many things she did that are probably attributed to her husband, many of the successful things we think her husband did. So she didn't have a good chronicler to kind of preserve her memory. But I was surprised at so much later Jewish tradition looking back. They record all these favorable stories about her. So I thought there must be something here, and everyone's naming their daughters after her. So I thought it was a great untold story. So yeah. It was really a fun project to work on.
How long did it take you? I mean, as you said, people said it couldn't be done. How long did it take you to put all of the pieces of this puzzle together?
About 7 years. And looking for clues, and then I wrote various articles along the way, gave various speeches, and people were it was the most popular presentations I've ever done at academic meetings. People have never heard of her, and they're just shocked so much is out there, and that kept stimulating me to look for more. And more. The more I searched, the more I began to uncover.
Where did you look?
Mainly a lot of ancient manuscripts, text, you had to read like whole texts, ancient history books, letters, economic documents, clues, just reading it by rote, occasionally find a reference. So there's really no place to begin. So anything written in the time period. Then surprisingly, I found some later Christian texts where they're documenting incidents in her life, and they're using books that are now lost. They were hundreds of years old in their time, and that was very valuable. So it's like a jigsaw puzzle in which most of the pieces are missing. So just reconstruct a few here, a few there. And then also by looking at her relatives, her family, like when she's young, where were her parents? So that told me a great deal about her life, what it was like to grow up.
What do you think it was about her that grabbed you so much? I mean, so many people had overlooked her for so long.
I was very interested in the Roman conquest, how the Romans came, conquered the country. And it took place about a year and a half after she died. So I was looking what happened before. Why didn't it occur earlier? There are all these invaders, nations. There was an invasion from the Armenian king Tigranes that he never conquered her country. And even the Jewish historian Josephus admits he pushed her back. And I thought, who was this powerful woman? And why did you have this kind of gap in the historical record where supposedly nothing happened before her, after her? It was just chaos, constant invasion, death, war. And it was just this missing hole in history. And to find her name in the Dead Sea Scrolls, thought of all people, why her? And then there are also calendars in the Dead Sea Scrolls kind of tracking events of her reign, which she's very important to them. And they kind of believed her reign marked the end of history. And all the calendars, most of the Dead Sea Scrolls kind of cease after her reign. So it was a very important period of history. And the Dead Sea Scroll community went a profound change after her reign. And looking at all these things, that made me realize she's really a key figure for understanding what happened before and after. And she's one of these individuals that really shaped the times in which she lived. Rather than her husband was kind of shaped by his period, she just changed the whole world and affected the surrounding nations. And I was also fascinated looking that of Syria to the north, Egypt, and for a while, Arabia were all ruled by women during this period, which is kind of a very unique period of history, which is very not really covered very much in depth.
Fascinating. Well, we have to take a short break, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. I'm talking with Kenneth Atkinson. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa, and we're talking today about Queen Salome Alexandra. She ruled Judea. She was the only woman monarch of Judea, and she ruled from 76 to 67 BCE, a remarkable woman who ruled during the Golden Age of Judea. We'll find out more about her and her life and the research that Kenneth Atkinson has done in a moment. You're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm talking right now with Kenneth Atkinson. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa, and he's written the book Queen Salome, Jerusalem's Warrior Monarch of the First Century BCE. We figure that this would be an appropriate time to talk about Queen Salome because it is her family, the Maccabees, that are celebrated. Their deeds are celebrated during Hanukkah. But also a wonderful time to talk about her just because this is someone that very few people have ever heard of. And she really was a remarkable woman who put her stamp on Judaism as we know it today. Let's go back to talk about her rule. As we mentioned earlier, when her husband died, really, she was very popular. He was very unpopular. And he had not only been at war almost throughout his entire rule, he'd also killed his own people. Yes. And so although he was hated, she was this beloved figure. And really, it was the people who said, we want you to be our queen. The other stories that you allude to in the book about other rulers show us that sons who should be king and would inherit thrones, you know, could be very violent. Why do you think she was able to take over as queen without her sons, who were grown at the time, and really one of them should have been king? Why didn't they try to take the throne?
Yeah. Well, one reason I argue in the book is I thought of that question, looked at the neighboring countries, and at this time, the whole Middle East is very influenced by Greek culture, which is what started the Maccabean Rebellion with Hanukkah, when the Greeks were interfering with Judaism. But after Alexander the Great's conquest, the region absorbed many, many Greek influences. And in ancient Greek society, it was common for women to rule. And the Syrian Greeks, Egyptian Greeks who ruled those countries had a long tradition of female rule. And she knew some of these rulers, and all of her family did. So I think over time, people just became accustomed to seeing the idea of competent female monarchs. And when her husband died, her two sons hated one another. And they apparently hated one another so much that when she built a palace at Jericho in an oasis, she built two identical palaces adjacent to one another, one for each of them. So even in their leisure time, they couldn't get along. And I believe people knew what would happen if one of them reigned. The other would try to overthrow the sibling, and people said, she's pious, let's put her in charge. She's been effectively monarch during her husband's many absences and illnesses. And during his last years, he was afflicted by probably liver damage from constant alcoholism, malaria. He was pretty ill. So she was effective ruler. So when she took the throne, she had probably been ruling for about 3 years. And people said, it works, don't mess with it.
And it's fairly clear in the historical record that you've uncovered that she did have a favorite son.
Yes, her elder son, Hyrcanus, she appointed high priest. He was a Pharisee. he was a very more quiet, religious, devout son, very much like her. Her younger son, Aristobulus, was a Sadducee like his father and like his father, a warrior. But yet during her reign, she managed to make them get along. She put her youngest son in charge of her military, and he did quite well. And it built up the military into a large defensive force, which kept the neighboring powers away. She made peace treaties. She put garrisons in enemy territories to monitor trade, keep peace. So she did somehow manage to force them to get along.
And it strikes me in reading about her military strategy, she was one of the early practitioners of mutually assured destruction. I mean, she built up the army and she brought in mercenaries as well, not to fight, but just to scare off everyone else.
Yes, and it worked. It was very effective. And the greatest threat to her reign was a man named Tigranes from Armenia, who's the only ruler the Romans never managed to conquer. He kept his kingdom intact. He invaded the Middle East. She pushed him out with this large defensive army, showed up one day, and he said, okay, I'm going to leave. I've got bigger things to worry about with the Romans. So she's the one person he never attacked.
The fact that she practiced her religion differently from how her husband practiced his religion, there had to be a lot of domestic changes within Judea because of her differing beliefs. What do we know about how she changed life for the people that she ruled?
Well, once she took power, appointed her son as high priest, she appoints most of the court system, makes sure they're predominantly Pharisees. So when you would worship in the temple, the priests would conduct the worship according to the Pharisees' rules and regulations. There are many oral traditions, how the sacrifices were conducted, the prayers, the rituals. They would affect pretty much everything, the ritual. It's a modern comparison would be kind of the difference between a Catholic and a Protestant church. They're worshiping the same God, but they're very, very different ways. In Judaism, if most people were Pharisees, but they had to worship the Sadducee way in the temple because the priest ruled it. So you had no choice. There was no diversity. So she was much more tolerant and lenient. But yet in the court, she did allow Sadducees to rule. So there was theological diversity, debate. And she didn't force her will down. But most of the people really agreed with her interpretation of Judaism.
So as I mentioned earlier, when her husband was leader, he oppressed the Pharisee people and actually would crucify his own people and killed many of his own people. So when she took over and then appointed her son, who was a Pharisee, as the high priest. She didn't turn around and oppress the Sadducees?
No, there are even stories of Sadducees coming to her when she took power asking for justice, and she says, I'll protect you. And by appointing her son as commander of the military, that made it clear that there's going to be no violence. We're not going after these people.
So really, she, although she had very strong religious beliefs and as you mentioned, was a very pious woman, she made it safe for something like religious freedom in her country.
Yes, the closest in antiquity you can find. And many Sadducees did hold positions in military, high office. So she managed to bring everyone together for the sake of unity. And most people were just so tired of the wars, the economy crashed, and it was working. So they were happy to have her in power.
So they had religious freedom. They had relative peace, although a very strong military. We mentioned earlier that she invested in education as well.
Yes, which is very unique in antiquity. And that struck me looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls. They really seem to bloom. And there are many references in the scrolls to women religious leaders. They're not completely equal to men, but they do list of rules for them. They're respected members. They can even testify against men in courts. And the Essenes, even though they're kind of a schismatic, extremist sect, they did give women certain rights. They could testify against their husbands if they violate purity laws. There's even reference to women scribe. So it's the closest women in antiquity in ancient Israel had to equality.
And this was the time of Jesus.
Yeah, she lived a little before Jesus, okay. In the first century B.C. She shaped the Jesus, Judaism that Jesus grew up in. So the religion of Jesus was the religion that she largely created.
Her rule was 9 years, which is a significant amount of time, although a blip, really,
yes.
Really, when you look at it historically. What happened at the end of her rule?
Well, when she died, her eldest son she appointed to take over. And he lasted 3 months. His younger son gathered an army, threw him out of office. And they were fighting one another. And the Romans heard about this and said, we'll help mediate this conflict. They foolishly said yes. And the Roman general Pompey came in 63 BC, laid siege to Jerusalem, destroyed much of the temple, the city, took over. That was the end of her nation. And so when Jesus grows up, the glory age they look back to was this time period. And Jesus even celebrated Hanukkah. He would have known about her life, her story. And her name became the second most popular name for women. And so when Jesus rules, they have this memory of once they were great power, now they're kind of occupied. The Romans have kind of created a new monarchy with a man named Herod the Great, who's kind of a stooge for the Romans. So in the symbols of nationalism they carried around, really symbols that she used, like the palm branch, which when Jesus' followers waved that, that's a symbol of Hasmonean nationalism, kind of like waving the American flag around. So her life really affected, you know, the world in which Jesus grew up.
Well, and it affected the world that we live in
yes.
today as well. She was so well-known, so wildly popular, did so many important things. Why do you think she was basically lost to history?
Well, most of the historians who recorded this period were pretty sexist. They did not like women. And our main chronicler is a man named Josephus, who lived in the first century, born about a few years before Jesus' death, knew a couple people mentioned in the New Testament, took the earlier records, produced two major histories of this time period, and he was very sexist. We don't know the names of his three wives, his mother, any women, his family. He clearly did not want to admit that the greatest reign in history was under a woman. So he kind of overlooks a lot of things, ascribes many things she did to her husband. So I had to very much read between the lines and look at dates and see, well, his chronology is off, and then start looking at little clues that were preserved in other accounts.
Well, and the fact that her rule sounds so very different from her husband's, that must have almost seemed like the things that he was given credit for were completely opposite of what he'd been doing just a few years before.
Yes, and it's unfortunately we don't know more about the relations with the two. He was a pretty horrible man, consorted with concubines, prostitutes, killing everyone.
Which was what many men of his time and status did.
It was unfortunately common, but it would be nice to know what happened at home, their conversations, what it was like. I'm sure they must have had many fights and arguments.
It's fascinating to think. I mean, she was clearly a remarkable and very intelligent woman, but she was also in the right place at the right time.
Yes, if she had been born a bit earlier or later, it would be impossible to rule because the country was open through Greek influences. The idea of a woman monarch, a few years later, the Romans conquered the country. So it was a very narrow window of history, but yet she stood up and she not just didn't passively accept what was going on, she really shaped the times in which she lived. Changed the country overnight. The military was a very active ruler, so she wasn't passive at all, which makes her quite amazing. It was such a threat, she kept all the neighboring powers away and pretty much kicked out King Tigranes from the country. So she was a very formidable person, and King Tigranes seems scared to fight her. He fought the Romans, but he's kind of worried about her.
The fact that so many women were named after her makes me think that she must have been someone that stories were told about. There must have been an oral tradition that passed along what she had done.
Yes, and a few of those I think have survived in some later literature I've discovered. Even as late as the Italian Renaissance, there's some oral stories about her. It's hard to know the historical basis for many of these, but I record some of these in my book. And the Talmud records many, many stories about her. So there must have been a vast body of oral literature which is kind of lost to us. So it's amazing I found enough to piece together her whole life.
Yeah.
Just little fragments of history here and there that are preserved.
So today, whether we're Jewish or not, I mean, it sounds to me that there are still things that she paved the way for, still some of her groundbreaking actions that affect all of us. Well, how do you frame her legacy? How do you see that?
She really lived at a time in many respects very much like our own. It's a period of cultural clash, Greek culture, traditional Jewish culture, nations becoming more cosmopolitan, different ethnic groups, constant war, economic downturn, many of the problems we look at today. And yet she tackled these head on and made many unpopular decisions. And at this period in which she lived, most of her predecessors were killed for trying to do things like this. And yet she took the risk. But it was because of her honesty and her piety. And I think she really, for me, shows the example of living your values, doing what you think is right, regardless of the cost and the potential danger. And people really respected her. And she amazingly managed to pull it off. And for a country in which it's very much a sexist world, for a woman to be so dominant, to be so successful, that says a great deal about her. And that men willingly accepted her when she had two grown sons. So they obviously were happy to obey her orders. The military listened to her. So she was not only the leader of her country, the queen, but commander of the military.
Makes you wonder how many other remarkable women have been completely lost from history,
yes,
given that only men of the time were written about. As you have pieced all of this together, you've published your book, you've been talking at academic conferences and talking to other scholars about Queen Salome. Where do you think this goes next? A lot of people must be excited.
Yeah, I've just finished an academic book looking at her and her whole family for scholars. It'll have very detailed, dense footnotes. This book is meant to be semi-popular, something my students can read. They won't put them to sleep. This will be an academic book for scholars, very boring, dense, but we'll give them all the technical, detailed evidence. I think it's important for scholars to do both, to write for the public, speak for the public, let them know what we're doing, stories like this, as well as do the traditional academic books.
Have you been surprised by people's response to Queen Salome?
Yeah, very, very surprised. It's every time I speak on this at conferences, it attracts a very large audience, and people are just simply fascinated. They want to know, am I publishing more on about the topic? And I'm amazed that so many prominent people know nothing about her. She's not in the book. She's not taught at school. Just had maybe a sentence or two about her when I was in graduate school. So they're amazed that there's a whole period of history in this pivotal historical period that no one's touched.
Well, and she sounds ready-made for Hollywood, too. Have you had any movie producers getting in touch with you yet?
No, I've always thought this would make a great film. It's such an amazing story, the characters.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. And maybe you'll popularize the name Salome as well.
Yes.
Kenneth Atkinson, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kenneth Atkinson is an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. We've been talking today about Queen Salome Alexandra, a remarkable woman who was nearly lost to history. His book is called Queen Salome, Jerusalem's Warrior Monarch of the First Century BCE. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we also right now want to hear your stories about a person who has affected your life dramatically through some act of kindness or a series of acts of kindness. If there's a teacher, a mentor, a family member, a kind stranger, someone who has impacted your life dramatically, we want to hear your story. We may use it on the air, and you can send us your story at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.